Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Peter Hart of the Media Watch Group FAIR, who assesses the corporate media's coverage of the U.S. healthcare reform debate and conservative activists' disruption of congressional town hall meetings. Kelly Brownell of the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity, who looks at the complex issues contributing to the increase in obesity in America and the high cost of treating the condition. And sociologist and author Gregory Wilpert, who examines the Venezuelan government's decision to revoke broadcast licenses from 34 privately owned broadcast outlets. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In a move to win cooperation on Darfur, the Obama administration's envoy to Sudan, retired Air Force General Scott Gratian, told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in July that genocide is no longer occurring in the war-torn western edge of Sudan. The envoy is pushing for a new peace deal amongst warring factions in Darfur. Meanwhile, Sudan President Omar Bashir faces an arrest warrant for war crimes committed in Darfur issued by the International Criminal Court. Bashir also received wide criticism in March when Sudan kicked out 13 Western-based humanitarian groups from Darfur. General Gratian, in his Senate testimony, called for Sudan to be taken off the State Department's list of countries supporting terrorism and rolling back sanctions on Sudan that were imposed during the Clinton years, saying they are hurting rebuilding efforts. A recent State Department analysis of Darfur, released by human rights activists, showed over 3,300 villages were damaged or destroyed between 2003 and 2005, but few villages have been attacked since 2006. UN agencies are concerned displaced people will stay in settlement camps out of fear of returning to violence-plagued villages in Darfur. Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy has held up the release of anti-drug funds to Mexico over growing concerns about human rights abuses. The State Department had planned to release a favorable report on Mexican progress on human rights in advance of the regional summit in Guadalajara, Mexico, between President Obama, Mexican President Felipe Calderon, and Prime Minister Stephen Harper of Canada, but the plan was dropped after Leahy objected. According to the Washington Post, $100 million in anti-drug funds to Mexico is being withheld, part of the Merida initiative crafted in 2007. The law requires Congress to withhold 15% of anti-drug funds until the U.S. State Department declares Mexico has made progress on human rights. Since Mexican President Calderon launched his offensive against drug traffickers in December 2006, human rights complaints against the military have soared 600%, with about 160 complaints a month. Mexico's National Human Rights Commission has found evidence of torture by the military in 17 of the cases it has investigated. Human Rights Watch, in a report issued last April, observed, "Not one of the military investigations of these crimes has led to a conviction of even a single soldier on human rights violations." The Mexico Supreme Court is now reviewing a case to see if civilian authorities can investigate abuse complaints against the military. Solar installations in California are booming thanks to falling silicon chip prices and new government incentives like tax cuts in the Obama stimulus package. According to the Los Angeles Times, June was a record month for California homeowners seeking solar rebates. The primary expense of solar is upfront installation costs, or about $20,000 for a well-designed solar power system. There is little cost for producing residential electricity after that. Over the last year, prices for high-quality silicon chips have fallen by 50%. As a result, prices for installing solar in California has fallen by $2.50 per watt. The rush to solar has also developed new financing options for homeowners who cannot afford the $20,000 installation cost. Purchasing agreements allow a company to install and manage a solar system. The consumer pays a fixed rate for the electricity produced and a management fee for the solar company. Another alternative is group buying of solar through companies like One Block Off the Grid. The company organizes homeowner groups of 100 or more to negotiate discounts with solar installers. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
Conservative groups opposed to health care reform being pushed by President Obama and the Democratic-controlled Congress have succeeded in distracting the national media's attention away from a substantive debate on the issues and toward a litany of false and bizarre accusations. Among the irresponsible claims being made by right-wing activists affiliated with corporate-sponsored organizations are that Democratic Party-supported health care reform legislation will force the euthanasia of senior citizens, mandate abortions for handicapped fetuses, and abolish the nation's private insurance companies. Echoing the rants of conservative radio talk show hosts, some activists compare President Barack Obama with Adolf Hitler and his health care plan to the Holocaust. While much of the U.S. corporate media is eager to amplify these crude lies, most of the coverage fails to dig deeper to reveal the groups behind the campaign to misinform the public and disrupt congressional town hall meetings. Among these groups are Americans for Prosperity and FreedomWorks. FreedomWorks' chairman is former Republican House Majority Leader Dick Armey, a senior policy advisor with the law firm DLA Piper, which represents major energy corporations and the pharmaceutical industry. FreedomWorks is funded by the right-wing Koch, Scaife, Bradley, and Olin Foundations. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Peter Hart, activism director with the Media Watch Group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR. Hart assesses the corporate media's coverage of the U.S. health care reform debate and conservative activist disruption of congressional town hall meetings.
Yeah, the first thing you probably think when you see it is you wonder where the media got this sudden interest in listening to and amplifying grassroots concerns. I've never known this to be very typical of the corporate media to care so much about what protesters think, but suddenly they've found protesters here, I think, that have been able to flesh out a storyline that the media want to tell, and that is that there are passions that are running hot on both sides of this issue. On the one side, people, the pro-reform camp with the White House, with the congressional Democrats. On the other side, these folks who are, whatever their motivation, going to these town hall meetings and disrupting them, shouting, comparing the White House efforts to Nazi Germany, and so on. It's a little confusing when you try to get a sense of what's going on here. I was just listening to a right-wing talk show host, and one of the callers had just participated in one of these protests, and he was saying that we were all there anti-health care. So you have to sit and wonder what their beef is, and apparently his was with the idea of health care. You know, this is, I think, a situation where the media, whatever the motivations of the protesters, the media are wildly overplaying these folks as a testament to real legitimate public concern. If you look at the public opinion on the health care efforts, the majority are with the White House plan. The majority would go much further than the White House and the congressional Democrats are going. That perspective is almost never heard. But what you do hear a lot are these naysayers who are a minority of the population. And I think what they've done is they've sown enough mistrust, they've sown enough anger, and they've spoken up loudly and clearly enough that people are turned off by this whole issue in general, and you're seeing a kind of public fatigue with this issue at all. And that gets interpreted in the media as Obama losing control of the message, losing control of this story, reforms on the ropes, blah, blah, blah. That's really the main way the media cover this. It's as if we're not talking about the health of all of our citizens. We're talking about a political football that people are throwing back and forth.
Has the media gone in any depth to attempt to figure out who these groups are that are organizing these folks, their talking points, and what actually is being planned behind the scenes to disrupt these town hall meetings? Two of the groups have sort of risen above the radar screen, and that is Americans for Prosperity and a group called FreedomWorks, with ties to a large corporate interest. You want to mention what the media has done or not done in regards to letting the public know who's behind these protests?
I think there's been some reporting at the margins. I think one of the great failures is the failure to simply fact-check these things. We can sit here and say, of course, there isn't a forced euthanasia plan in this, in any of these bills. It's obvious. I think it would be nonsensical to think otherwise. And yet, the media don't do a very good job of explaining this to the public. And maybe they feel like it's already well known, but you do see that there are people who believe this, and they're animated enough and angry enough to go to a town hall meeting and yell at their senator or their congress member over it. That suggests that this message is not being challenged forcefully enough, that one story in the paper on one day doesn't do the trick. I think one of the problems the media are falling into is this idea that everybody is exaggerating on all sides. So you see these stories. It was one in the New York Times and one in the Washington Post. Washington Post editorial over the weekend had the same kind of story where they say, you've got it on both sides. The Post editorial was remarkable because they had really four things that they objected to, and three of them were things that the Democrats in Washington were apparently doing that weren't true. One of the problems they had with the debate was that Obama was pointing out that the health insurance companies are very profitable, and that's an exaggeration to them. So you've got one side saying that the health insurance industry makes a lot of money, the other side saying there's a Nazi plot to kill all old people, and the media are in the middle and saying, well, both of those are wrong. It does a tremendous disservice to people, and I think a lot of this could be nipped in the bud if the media stood up and did that job. Going the extra mile and trying to figure out who's behind some of these protests, I think it would be fantastic for the press to do that, but they haven't done job one yet, which is to inform people about what is and isn't in any of these bills. And I think that's the real failure.
It just seems that we don't ever really get the kind of mainstream coverage of the basic political commerce that goes on in terms of who's getting the money. Follow the money is the old adage, and it's certainly true in this case. If we follow the money, we really would know, who's pulling the strings in terms of the opposition to health care reform and who's going to lose.
I think that is the old adage that every reporter swears by, follow the money. And in this case, there have been a couple of reports. I think the main report on this was in USA Today, if I'm not mistaken, but it was about where these so-called blue dog Democrats were getting their money, and it was largely from the industry. So you could take it as a just a peculiar coincidence that they happen to have these industry-friendly ideas, and they seem to be the politicians well-positioned to prevent any kind of White House-backed reform. That's either a coincidence or it's a function of where they're getting their money. Now, Washington is certainly a cynical place, and the media is full of cynics in Washington. And you would think that they would put these two things together and say, well, I think I've figured this story out. So this is, the simplest part of the story, and it's the one that I think evades a lot of scrutiny in the press.
That was Peter Hart, activism director with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR. Contact FAIR at area code 212-633-6700, or visit their website at fair.org. A recent report shows that the cost of treating obesity has doubled in the past 10 years, and that obese people spent 42% more on medical costs in 2006 than people of normal weight. As the debate on health care reform heats up, this is one area where policymakers are looking to reduce costs through prevention programs. But the problem is complex, involving lifestyle, economics, psychology, and the outsized impact of the food industry and its marketing arm. Giant food corporations market their products to children and teenagers, spending over $1.6 billion annually in advertising. The overwhelming majority of these ads, targeting schools, the internet, and mobile phones, are for unhealthy snack foods, high in calories, sugar, fat, and/or sodium. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Kelly Brownell, founding director of the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. He says blaming or shaming people for their weight problems is counterproductive and suggests several policy changes that could help prevent and reduce obesity and its corresponding personal and social costs.
When one looks at all the contributors to obesity, you have a list a mile long. Increasing portion sizes, physical activity being subtracted out of schools, value meal type pricing that encourages people to buy lots of unhealthy foods, food marketing directed at children. And, I mean, we could spend 2 hours going through the list of contributors. the food industry uses this to support their position that why pick on us? Why should we change because there are so many things going on? That sort of philosophy basically paralyzes you from doing anything because why do A when B might be the big driver or C or D? So it makes sense to get rid of that philosophy and think more broadly about what are some of the obvious contributors. First of all, the price of food is an obvious contributor. It's just simply true that it costs more to buy good food than it does to buy unhealthy food. And that's especially true if you're poor and you live in certain neighborhoods where you just don't have access to a lot of things like fresh fruits and vegetables. It's also the case that food marketing is a huge issue. It's like a tidal wave enveloping the nation. By educating people, it's like giving people swimming lessons while the tidal wave is coming in. You just simply can't do it. A few people might be able to swim under those conditions, but most won't, and that's what's happening now. So food marketing has to change. There's a wonderful precedent with tobacco, the single most effective thing ever done to stem the tide of smoking in the country was to raise prices through taxes, and the economists have shown that in study after study. So we believe that that same principle should apply to food. So we have proposed, in particular, a tax on sugar-sweetened beverages. And we proposed a penny an ounce tax with the money to be raised from such a tax to be used for nutrition-related programs. And we think that's a winning idea because there's clear science on sugar-sweetened beverages showing that they're contributing to diseases like obesity and diabetes, stronger science than there is for any other category of foods. Some other categories are close behind, and the science is building, but it's rock solid in the area of sugar-sweetened beverages. And so a tax like that, especially if the money were raised from it would be used wisely, I think could be a public health home run. And given the tobacco precedent, it makes all the sense in the world.
Do you feel like the climate is right for some significant changes and any other pieces that you think are ready to sort of pop?
I see very good news on the horizon, and partly it's because of the signs that the public cares more about the quality of food than its quantity. It used to be the case that Americans just wanted more food for less money, so they'd pile it on and get these enormous helpings at restaurants, etc. There's still some of that, to be sure, but the Americans care more about the story of their food. They want to know more where it came from, who grew it, how far it was shipped, even to some extent the impact on the environment of different food choices they make. That's all very good. At the moment, there are a lot of groups working on this issue. They tend not to be working in a coordinated way. So you have the groups interested in hunger, for example, other groups interested in obesity, others interested in sustainability and the impact of food choices on the environment. I believe that if all these groups could come together and work on a common set of themes, it could be a very powerful movement and push ahead the public policy agenda even more quickly than it would be otherwise.
Okay, so in terms of food marketing, I believe that there's restrictions on TV advertising of certain items, tickets. There's not.
Huh. No. Basically, food marketing is a free-for-all. There are almost no restrictions on the food industry, even self-imposed restrictions on who they can advertise to, what they can advertise, and how they advertise it. And as a consequence, there's an overwhelming bad message that's being delivered, especially to children. And the marketing used to be pretty simple. It was confined. When I was a boy, for example, there were Saturday morning cartoons. There were ads for sugared cereals on that, and that's about all you saw. A little bit more, but not too much. But now it's everywhere. It's product placements, and people don't recognize it as advertising. Product placements are in movies. And a new and very difficult-to-monitor problem is digital marketing, marketing on the Internet in particular. So the cereal companies have websites. All the candy companies, do they all have websites where children can go and play these interactive games? And it's a very cost-efficient way to market because the industry just has a one-time cost to build the website. And then, you know, millions of people could visit it, and it doesn't cost them anything more to run it. Compared to a food ad where somebody watches it for 15 or 30 seconds on television, it's a big expense for the industry, and then the impact is gone. We and others have found that when children go on these websites, they're there for an average of 20 minutes or so. The whole marketing landscape is changing. Soon, because there are GPS chips in cell phones, people, kids included, will start to get food advertisements directed to their location. So they'll get off school, power up their cell phone, and get an ad that says something like, "Are you hungry? There's a donut shop two blocks on your right. Here's a 50 cents off a dozen," or something. These things are end runs around parents. Parents used to have trouble monitoring children's exposure to this, but now it's nearly impossible. There's a clear role for government to step in and do something about this. And so one major policy change has to be to limit the amount of marketing of unhealthy food directed at children.
That was Kelly Brownell of the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity. Contact the center by calling area code 203-432-6690 or visit their website at yaleruddcenter.org. In early August, the government of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez revoked the broadcast licenses of 32 privately held radio stations and two regional television stations, triggering objections from opposition groups. According to officials at Venezuela's telecommunications agency, Conatel, the decision on the radio stations was made because their licenses had expired or they had violated government regulations. The status of another 200 station licenses are currently under review. Licenses from the closed outlets will be transferred to community media groups. Nelson Belfort, president of the Chamber of Radio Broadcasters in Circuito Nacional Belfort, owner of five of the closed stations, charged that the revocation of licenses is a government attack on freedom of expression. The Chavez government and privately owned media outlets have clashed repeatedly in recent years, particularly since many media outlets supported the failed coup attempt against President Chavez in April 2002. In May 2007, tensions were heightened when the Chavez government denied the national opposition television station RCTV a renewal of their license. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with sociologist and author Gregory Wilpert, a former U.S. Fulbright scholar who lived in Venezuela for many years. He examines the long-running media-government conflict in Venezuela and the charge that Chavez is attempting to suppress all opposition criticism of his government.
First of all, one has to be aware of the fact that Venezuela has over 600 radio stations, so this is affecting, so far, a small fraction of the existing radio stations. Secondly, most of these radio stations are all commercial stations that play mostly music and are not explicitly political. I mean, it's being portrayed as a eminently political kind of action of the Chavez government, but I don't think you can really say that. I mean, it does have some political dimensions to it in the sense that there's been a long-running conflict between the Chavez government and the private mass media in Venezuela, and so certainly you have to see it a bit in that context. On the other hand, these radio stations and broadcasters in Venezuela in general has regularly violated broadcast regulations and for using the public airwaves, and the government has decided to basically enforce the laws. Some people say this is an opportunistic effort on the Chavez government. I think there might be some element of that. On the other hand, it is necessary to regulate the use of public airwaves. The conflict between Chavez and the private mass media also goes back to the 2002 coup attempt, and the fact that the private mass media have been waging a nonstop and continuous campaign to get rid of Chavez. So in that sense, there is this political dimension to it, like I said.
Greg Wilpert, what happens to the licenses of these 34 privately held radio stations that were taken off the air? Are they going to community groups and cooperatives? What's going to happen there?
Yes, that's basically what they've announced. Venezuela has expanded the use of the airways for community media tremendously, and it looks like that this will happen with those stations as well. At least that's what the government has been saying. And these are, you know, the opposition likes to say that these are all, you know, state channels, but that's simply not true. They're really very independently. If you listen to them, they tend to support the Chavez government, but they're also critical of the government, and they are completely independent, with some even being more opposition-oriented. That's the most likely thing to happen, is that they will be turned over to cooperatives and community media, and that's part of the larger program, of, according to the government, to democratize the airwaves.
Greg, there's been some disturbing news coming out of Venezuela. Not too long ago, Attorney General Luisa Ortega Diaz said that the government must confront crimes of opinion, new forms of criminality created by the abuse and exercise of freedom of information and opinion needs to be confronted. What can you tell us about this statement from the Attorney General under Hugo Chavez, as some of that language seems quite Orwellian?
Yeah, I agree. it is definitely sound quite disturbing. First of all, there's no concrete proposal that she made about this. She was arguing basically in support of a potential law that some legislators have been discussing. So far, it hasn't been presented to the full National Assembly. It's just in committee. And I think it's rather unlikely that it will be actually presented because among Chavez supporters, it's already generated quite a bit of uproar. I don't think that it will go very far.
Our corporate media continually says that there is no freedom of expression in Venezuela. I know there were a lot of active opposition newspapers on the streets every day when I visited Venezuela back in 2006. But have things changed dramatically, or with RCTV off the air and some of these radio stations off the air, has it really impinged on people's ability to criticize the government now?
No, none whatsoever. I mean, if you go to Venezuela today, you can buy any number of opposition-oriented newspapers. There's something like 10 daily newspapers in Venezuela, and I would say about 8 of them, or 7 or 8 of them, are very strongly opposition-oriented. Same thing with the major television broadcasters. RCTV actually continues to broadcast not over the airwaves, but over cable. And I would say almost half of the Venezuelan population receives cable television, so they get it and view it. It still has a fairly high large audience. Freedom of speech, I think, is quite alive and well in Venezuela. The opposition argues that the combination of incentives and of punishments has hemmed in freedom of speech, but I really don't see any concrete evidence for that.
That was Gregory Wilpert, a sociologist and freelance journalist. He is the author of Changing Venezuela by Taking Power, The History and Policies of the Chavez Government. Wilpert is an editor of the online publication VenezuelaAnalysis.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.